Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Michael Peterson was driven to succeed. An Army brat turned Marine, he saw combat in Vietnam and returned a decorated soldier. An avid reader, his dreams of being an acclaimed novelist came true. His desire to find love was fulfilled when he married brilliant executive Kathleen Atwater, the first female student accepted at Duke University's School of Engineering. The Petersons seemed like the ideal academic couple, well-respected, prosperous, and happy. All that came crashing down in December of 2001, when Kathleen apparently fell to her death in their secluded home in an exclusive area of Durham, North Carolina. But blood-spattered evidence and a missing fireplace poker suggested calculated, cold-blooded murder. Her trusted husband stood accused. Then the most damaging evidence of all surfaced. 16 years earlier, Peterson was the last person to see his neighbor alive, before she was found dead at the bottom of a staircase in her home in Germany. A dramatic trial followed in the explosive final chapter of a life that no novelist could ever have conceived. The book that we're featuring this evening is Written in Blood, a true story of murder and a 16-year-old secret that tore a family apart. With my special guest, journalist and author, Diane Fanning. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Diane Fanning.
Good evening, Dan. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
It is always a pleasure, and it's going to be always a treat for the audience, especially with this book, Written in Blood. I won't ask you how you became involved, because it's too much to talk about in too short a period of time. It's such a involved story and case. It's incredible. Let's go right to, as you do dramatically in the book, to the 911 call, December 9, 2001, in Durham, North Carolina. And it's a call Mary Allen takes from Michael Peterson from 1810 Cedar Street. What's the, as you do in the book, what does he convey in that short period of time on the phone? Tell us about that call.
He tells us that his wife has fallen down the stairs, and he says that he doesn't know if she's breathing or not. And the most remarkable thing of all is that not once did he mention to the 911 dispatcher that there was a lot of blood in the hallway. He never said it once, and yet that was the first thing everyone else noticed when they came into the home.
Right. Now, when you talk about the phone call that he makes, and we won't, of course, talk about it verbatim, everything he says in that phone call, but they are trying to get information from him while they're on the line, but yet at the same time, they've already dispatched that ambulance, and because of the particulars, then the police are also alerted to get to this location, 1810 Cedar Street. Now, the first people that arrive are EMS, Jay Rose and Ron Page, and we see their name later in the trial, of course. And tell us a little bit about Durham, North Carolina, and this house that Jay Rose and Ron Page, the EMS, are arriving at. Tell us a little bit about that and what they find and who they find at that residence at that time.
The house, it was huge. It was about 10,000 square feet. It was an old mansion in a very nice part of town. The mansion had once been in a movie, even The Stairway. There was a scene in the original movie, The Handmaid's Tale, that was filmed on that stairway when the home was owned by the same guy that went up to New England and got involved in that kerfuffle with trying to get into his home, own home, and being stopped by the police that ended in the beer summit with Obama.
Right.
So the house was amazing. You know, it has a lot of history, and it was very beautiful, but it did need some extensive additional work on it. There were bats in the belfry, as it were, and they had a number of just structural things that needed to be corrected. The house wasn't about to fall down by any means, and you couldn't tell by looking at it that it had, but it did have some problems like many old homes do.
Now, when the EMS arrived, Jay Rose and Ron Page, what is Michael Peterson doing? And you introduced Todd Peterson, which is Michael's son. What do these EMS people arrive to find? And again, you mentioned that everyone responds or did respond to the amount of blood, and they remarked accordingly. So tell us a little bit about their arrival and what do they notice, anything unusual. Tell us about what they encounter.
They noticed that Michael Peterson wasn't wearing his shoes, and they noticed that the blood had started to dry already. And Peterson was telling them that that it only had been 45 minutes since he came in from the house and found her like this, and the blood wouldn't be dry. There was also a spot on the wall that looked like someone had been smearing it as if they were trying to clean it up. And Todd Peterson was there, and he was doing most of the talking. Now, he supposedly just arrived there, but there was evidence that came out later that indicated that that wasn't the first time he'd been back into that house since Kathleen died on the stairs.
Well, now, when police arrive, and to anybody that asks, what's the story he says about where he was when Kathleen, his wife, falls to her death? Where
so
is
this,
he?
This is a December night, late in the evening, and he claimed they were both sitting out by the pool. Now, that's not impossible. Durham is a little balmy, but after some time, Kathleen went in, and Michael Peterson said he continued to sit out there in a pair of shorts for another 45 minutes, which is pretty hard to believe in that weather. It was a little bit cool. He said when he came in, he found her like she was when they found her. But the thing of it is there was one thing that was noticed almost right away. There was a bloody footprint on the back of her pants.
Yeah. You write about all the ID techs and the CID, Criminal Investigation Division, that show up, and they see and remark the same thing, that the blood is congealed already in all of the locations. But each one of them also respond and remark to each other and later that this doesn't look like it's consistent with accidental fall. Not that they're the people that can assess that properly, but that was their first responses, wasn't it?
That was the first reaction, because there was an awful lot of blood in that stairway. When someone falls, yes, there's going to be blood, but not that copious and not that widespread. It was really shocking to all of them at the quantity of blood that was there. And also the fact that it was starting to dry out.
You also have that right away, Todd is making a statement to police, even without being officially interviewed, regarding alcohol, and also that Michael Peterson, and it was corroborated story that of Todd and a date, that they had been at the house earlier. What's the story that Michael Peterson talks about involving the evening that they spent earlier and alcohol and what Todd had said to anybody that would even listen?
Well, Michael had said that they had watched a movie and had gotten a call saying that the movie option had been renewed on his book. And they were kind of celebrating and having a little bit of champagne and toasting the night. And Todd Peterson came in and he said to the police that he did everything but call her a drunk. And said that she must have stumbled and fell because she'd been drinking, and really did make it sound like that alcoholic misbehavior was a hallmark of existence. Which, since she was a very, very successful six-figure businesswoman, that didn't seem very likely.
Now you have introduced some.
She used Valium. Yeah.
Go ahead.
He also said she used Valium.
Right. Now, the Valium actually, though, happens to be correct. She did even say to some of her friends that she had been using Valium as of late.
Yeah, things were really stressful at her job, and her boss had just been fired. So there was a lot of consternation in the office place, and a lot of that was left for her to try to subdue, so she had to stay calm for everyone else. And she was stressing a bit. And there was also the economics of their life had been getting a little tighter. They were still pretty much supporting Michael's two grown sons, in addition to having three girls in the household who would soon be ready to go off to college.
Right. Let's talk about a little bit about the situation that investigators find out soon enough, because this is just one little part of the story, and this incredible story that it is. Tell us a little bit more about Kathleen, because we introduced her as this incredible intellectual, basically, and certainly look like a dynamic academic couple like which introduced in the beginning. Tell us a little bit more about her work at Nortel and the kind of financial success that she was having for a few years.
Yes,
certainly.
At Nortel, she had been traveling all over the world, even to Russia, to help them set up communication systems. And she was a very busy woman. In fact, the next morning she was preparing to go to Toronto for a business meeting. So she was a real dynamo. She had a lot of responsibility, and it took her all around the world. But that was only one side of her. She was much more than that as a person. Her favorite activity, believe it or not, was power washing the house. She loved to power wash the house, and she did all sorts of other things around the home, and she was a marvelous hostess. She would host these incredible parties, and she'd prepare all the food herself. So she was both a domestic goddess and a business whiz at the same time.
At the same time, you also write that it's a very difficult task, but coming into this marriage, there was already the adopted children, Martha and Margaret, and also his sons, Todd and another son. What was her relationship like to all people that could look at it? But in reality, what was her relationship with those children?
Well, she had her own daughter, Caitlin. And she also became the stepmother to the two other girls who were not adopted legally by Michael Peterson. And he said the reason he didn't adopt them was because their father had died in service to his country in the military. Their mother had died while she was a teacher for one of the schools for the children in the military. So they were both federal employees. They both that meant that they both the children got a lot of benefits because of that. And he wanted to keep the money rolling in, so he never would adopt them. So Kathleen became like another mother to them. They, you know, they lost their first mother by death when they were very little, and then they lost Michael's first wife, who was their stepmother, when the divorce happened and they came with Michael, and now they had Kathleen, and they adored her, and she was. She had a great relationship with them. And the two boys, on the other hand, didn't particularly care for Kathleen. And it might be kind of understandable. I mean, their mother was set by the wayside, and this other woman was now with father. So some of that anti-Kathleen sentiment could be understandable because of the situation.
Right. Now, with this, right away, police, within a short period of time, are looking for a search warrant. Michael Peterson seems to be very, very surprised, but right away, even before he is arrested, he contacts a lawyer, his friend Kerry Sutton. Tell us about what transpires shortly after, despite the story that he has given that she has fell to her death.
Well, they do try to obstruct the investigation, and Michael's brother comes from Nevada and sort of becomes an adjunct to the legal team. And then he says they need to hire a serious criminal lawyer, and that's when David Rudolph takes charge of the case. And right after his arrest, and he's just making a big deal over being a grieving widower, and he's also trying to get all of the family onto the same page to basically cover for him. And he even tries to do that with Kathleen's sisters. And he doesn't give them very much information. And so at first they're not suspicious, but then when they actually saw the scene of the crime, they knew that something had definitely gone wrong here. And when the autopsy came out, they had absolutely no doubts that Michael Peterson was responsible for Kathleen's death.
Right. You talk about Michael Peterson as well, and it comes out, and as we talk about in the introduction, that it comes out at some point, Margaret and Martha, we are talking about the children of this Elizabeth. And so tell us about Elizabeth and Germany, and go backwards as you do in the book to tell us about Michael Peterson and his life after the Army and in the military, and his ability to become the novelist, which was his dream. So take us back to Germany and how he became the guardian of Martha and Margaret.
Michael Peterson was married to a woman who had a job working in Germany as a teacher. And in that way, she met Elizabeth Ratliff, who was also a teacher. They taught in the same school. And they lived just a few doors away from each other. Elizabeth was married, and her husband was in the military. And he was on a mission in Panama, and he was just found dead in his bed one night. And so suddenly, Elizabeth is there with two little girls, just about 2 and 5 years old, and having to deal with her husband's death and everything else involved with being a single parent. And she was a bit overwhelmed at first, as anyone would be. Michael Peterson stepped in and offered to help her with the financial stuff. And since, you know, his wife was her friend, she was comfortable with that. And she and the girls often had Peterson's house. One night, after having dinner at their house, Michael brought them home, and he helped him put the two children in bed. And it is highly suspected by Elizabeth's sisters that there was something had gone wrong in the financial picture of Elizabeth Ratliff. There were things missing that shouldn't have been. And they suspect that Michael Peterson had in some way been ripping her off while he was supposedly helping her with the finances. And that is what caused the confrontation. And at the end of that confrontation, Elizabeth was dead at the foot of the stairs in a pool of blood with blood spatter all up and down the stairway. And Michael Peterson was seen running from the home.
Now, as you write in the book, a person named Barbara O'Hara, which plays very prominently in the story, and she ends up being this very, very caring nanny to help out with Elizabeth and children. And Michael Peterson, at one time, she had lived with the family, but Michael Peterson advised Liz to pay for her to have her own apartment and her own life. She is the person that discovered Liz that day.
Yes, and she was horrified, and of course it naturally draws up the big question: why did Michael want that woman out of the home? Why did he intervene in that way? Because everything seemed to be working fine. The only thing that remained was, without her in the home, Elizabeth would be alone. And during the day, no one would be in the house. And then the evening, you know, on school days, and in the evening, Barbara would be gone. And it was just kind of suspicious that he wanted her out of the home, as if he thought what he was doing would be picked up by someone else if he was messing with their finances. And also, it left her even more alone and reliant on him.
Now, in this first case, back in 1985, he's in Germany. He knows a little bit of German, but not much. But he knows enough. And because this is associated with the military, they send somebody in, and I guess, as you write, because they have assumptions, and based on the person going in is less experienced than maybe somebody might if they were assuming that it was foul play. Tell us how on earth he gets around this, it looks like, murder. How does he get past this with the German authorities?
Michael sort of, with the German authorities, were sort of backing down in to the military of the United States, because these were Americans, and so they were not asserting themselves in any kind of investigation. And Michael Peterson pretty much took charge of the scene, and he was telling them about a medical condition that she had, which I do not think had anything to do with her death.
No.
Maybe it increased the amount of blood flow, but that would have been about it. He just basically was telling the story, and there was no one else to speak for Elizabeth. And he basically conned everyone. And then the pathologist that did the autopsy, he was not a forensic pathologist. He had never done a forensic pathology. His main work was for people that died of illness, a sudden illness, or people who were killed in automobile crashes or other vehicular accidents. And so he was inexperienced and untrained in any kind of forensic approach to an autopsy. And he was just in above his head. And he basically took the word of Michael Peterson and the military, who believed him.
Yes, you're right that they end up writing something that is basically disputed later, obviously, but something to the tune of cranial hemorrhage, spontaneous cranial hemorrhage due to this disease that she may have had pre-existing.
Yeah.
So anyway, you say didn't have any good experience in forensic pathology whatsoever, and so they went along, amazingly, by the conning of Michael Peterson, so he was able to get away with this. Interesting, though, too, is that there was no will, or they didn't find a will, but he created another will as helping out Liz, and that's where he wrote a provision in and changed from the original will, as you write, to a provision that he would be the guardian, he or his wife would be the guardian of the two daughters, but also that he would also be able to control the finances to be able to support them and educate them as they saw fit. Isn't that correct?
Yes, he was very, very adept at taking charge of almost every situation. He was a very good manipulator, and he was a narcissist. He really felt that regular standards did not apply to him, and that whatever he needed, he could get.
Mm-hmm. Now back to the murder at hand, and back to the question at hand here. He eventually, with the aid of his lawyer, eventually is granted a bail, so that he is back out on the street and trying to work, and also most importantly, try to rally the support of his family, like you say, and at the same time try to convince members of Kathleen's family that he's innocent. Tell us how that proceeds, and also what the police are doing and finding in their investigation.
Well, one of the things that the police found was that there was a lot of homosexual pornography, both printed and on his computer. They found correspondence with a male escort that he had engaged in trying to set up a meeting. They heard from a number of people that he used to solicit men at the YMCA. So basically, he was leading a double life. And for Kathleen, this would have been a big problem. Not because she had any problem with homosexuality, but because she had problem with infidelity. She left her first husband because he had an affair, and she certainly wouldn't have tolerated her second husband fooling around on her, whether he was having an affair or just having one-nighters. So it was, and that is probably what brought everything to the tipping point that night. But the family, number one, Michael Peterson and his family were telling them that Kathleen knew all about that and she was okay with it. And they knew that couldn't be true because that was just not Kathleen. And then they were also, pushing her stumbling on the stairs because she'd had too much to drink. And none of it was really making sense. This was somebody that was getting ready to make a big business trip the next day. She was checking on the computer for details. And Michael's computer was one that she seldom ever went to because she usually used her business laptop, but she left it in the office. So it was highly unusual for her to even go into Michael's workspace at all, let alone go on his computer. So she probably encountered some of that material. Meanwhile, while all this is going on, the autopsy report finally gets released. And Kathleen's sisters, when they see that autopsy report and they see about the marks on the back of her skull, they know that, this was not just a simple fall. And they talk to Kathleen's biological daughter, Caitlin, and they tell her that she needs to look at the autopsy report because up to the point she was supporting her stepfather, Michael Peterson. I mean, she wasn't thinking that he could be responsible. And when she sat in her dorm room and looked at the autopsy report online, she was absolutely horrified. She's a bright girl. She knew that this wasn't right. And that's when she broke off with the family and Michael Peterson's efforts to have everybody all together with him singing his praises and telling the media that everything was okay started to disintegrate.
It's a particularly chilling scene that you have in the book where Caitlin calls Martha and Margaret, or one of them, pardon me, and tells one of them that they need to look at the same documents that she has, and they refuse. And that is, if that's not the beginning of the rift, that certainly widens that rift in the family, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, it does. And on a psychological level, you can really understand a lot of what was going on with Margaret and Martha. Here they were. They lost their dad. Then they lost their mom. Then they lost their first stepmom. Then they lost the second one. And all they have left, the only person, is Michael Peterson. Denial is a very strong thing that can come in to protect your psyche. And I think it clearly did for those two girls. And plus, not only that, a manipulative feedback from Michael Peterson, sort of painting this picture of it's us against the world. And they were all he had to cling to. And I can understand why they went that way, but I think it's very tragic because they lost contact with their mother's sisters, their aunts, and just then lost contact with their stepsister Caitlin, and it was really tragic all that Michael Peterson stole from them, and they never fought back against it.
Yes, absolutely. We're going to continue talking about Michael Peterson and Written in Blood. We're going to stop for a second to talk about Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. You choose chef-designed recipes. Cook incredible meals in as little as 20 minutes. Let Blue Apron do the meal prep for you. Perfectly portioned ingredients delivered right to your door. Every week, at least 3 recipes built with your busy schedule in mind, where Blue Apron has done the meal prep for you. Prepared sauces, spices, and ingredients. My wife and I just recently cooked the shrimp in smoky harissa sauce. Now, harissa sauce is a ground peppers. And this was simmered in tomato and garlic with couscous, olives, and surprisingly, currants. This was fantastic. Unique flavors and combinations, amazing taste. And it's always a surprise with Blue Apron. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/murder. That's blueapron.com/murder to get your first three meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. We talked about this incredible rift that was happening between the families, but now a grand jury is convened, Diane, December 20th, 2001. You have witnesses are heard like Dr. Radish, Agent Deaver, and the original investigator, Art Holland, and there is an indictment. So let's fast forward to what happens after that indictment with Michael Peterson and the entire family and the media treatment of this case and their interest in it.
The indictment charged Michael Peterson with first degree murder. And he was trying to use the media to his advantage. He also allowed a French production company to come in and start filming the documentary, which ultimately ended up on The Staircase. And they came in, and I talked to them at the trial, and they were thoroughly convinced of Michael Peterson's innocence, and they wanted to be the big heroes and do a documentary on that. And they had this attitude that they were in the South, and the South is so backward that he was just being picked on by the public because he was bisexual, and that he was just being picked on by the police because in his column in the newspaper, he had written things that were negative or judgmental of some of the things that happened in the police department. And right. Honestly, you know, the administration and the police department may have had issues with him, but the rank-and-file policemen and detectives who were on the scene had nothing against him. They thought that some of the things he brought out were important. And he, in some of them, they wouldn't miss one of his columns for the world. So, including the lead detective. So they painted a picture that was not reality, and it was something that the defense attorney took and ran with. He was always bringing up things in the trial without calling Southerners backwards, leaving that impression that he believed that. And it was, to me, it was a little disturbing because every day that I watched the trial, I was getting more and more evidence that pointed to Michael Peterson's guilt. And I couldn't understand why anyone couldn't see that.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and people have seen, the tactics used by David Rudolph. And a lot of people say, well, it's just a zealous, you know, very zealous defense, you know, a vigorous defense. But some of the stuff, as you write about in the book, and I agree, is very questionable to the extent that he goes to defend his client and how he treats some people on the witness stand in what you would think would be a sensitive nature. Tell us about some of his behavior.
Well, he was really very rude and aggressive and nasty to the sister of the deceased woman. Most defense attorneys won't do that. They won't bring the family members on the stand to tears. But he did. And he didn't care if he angered them. And I watched the jurors' faces, and some of them were horrified by the way he was behaving towards her. And I thought it was absolutely ruthless and dreadful when he cross-examined them. And then another time, when the prosecution had something that was gory or disturbing to show the jury, he put the screen up to the jury so that you couldn't see it unless you deliberately went around over to that side of the room. So the family didn't see that. And it was, they were very sensitive. The only thing you let everybody see was like the nice pictures of breathing, living Kathleen. But when David Rudolph got up there to defend Michael Peterson, he had this huge, big screen that you could see from every corner of the courtroom. He didn't warn the family members to look away. He just suddenly threw up on that screen a photograph of Kathleen laying dead at the foot of those stairs. And the expression on her face at that moment is something that has burned into my head and has stayed there to this day. I can still vividly see that picture. She just looked horrendous, and the horror on her face was unbelievable.
Yes, I can't even imagine what the people, the jurors, have to witness and endure, and also the victims, the families, members themselves, incredible, and anyone attending the court, actually. Tell us how it is that the former 1985 murder becomes admissible, and how it becomes that the exhumation takes place. Tell us about this incredible effort to add weight, even more weight, to this murder trial.
When Kathleen's sisters informed the police about the death of Elizabeth Ratliff, and they knew about it because of the two girls, Margaret and Martha. And so they went over to Germany. The detectives went over to Germany and checked it out, looked at the scene, and got all the reports. And they got a exhumation order to exhume Elizabeth Ratliff's body, and they brought it back to Durham so that the same person who did Kathleen's autopsy, Deborah Radish, could then do an autopsy on this body. And one of the amazing things she discovered was that the marks on the back of Elizabeth's skull were extremely similar to the marks on the back of Kathleen's skull. And blunt force trauma was something that couldn't be too heavy, but was hit hard enough to, you know, leave marks you could see on a skull. And that was very troublesome, and they investigated it. They talked to people who had been there at the time of the crime, and they brought a bunch of witnesses to Durham. And outside the presence of the jury, they had a hearing before the judge to determine whether or not the evidence was admissible. And it was the similarities more than anything that got that into the courtroom. I mean, how often is one person the last person to see a victim who's found dead at the foot of the stairs in a pool of blood? Two times. I mean, it's like, you know, lightning just doesn't strike in the exact same place twice. And this is what it all looked like. And it was a similar crime. And the reports that had been filed were highly inadequate. And it was obvious that no one had really investigated this, and no one with forensic experience had looked at the body at all.
The person we haven't spoken about at all, and if someone were listening carefully, they'd say, well, how about Michael Peterson's wife, Patty? Her unique situation with her friend dying, and knowing, as she says later on, knowing Michael Peterson for 40 years, what was her position about guilt or innocence, and what did she have to say to the police?
I think she could have seen him kill. I think she could have seen him kill Liz and would have still not believed it. That woman was so into standing by her man that she wouldn't even entertain the possibility that he was responsible. And in fact, she still, even though they were legally divorced, she still considered herself his wife, and she would always be his wife in her mind, because that you can't break who God has put together. You know, you can't bring it asunder. So she obviously had been controlled and manipulated by Michael Peterson for years, and somehow, even when she was free from him, she allowed herself to be that way with him anyway. And it was kind of bizarre, actually. You don't see someone who is that intentionally blind. And it wasn't just these two dead women. I mean, she knew that another good friend of hers accused him of stealing money and credit cards from her wallet. And she'd seen him use the cards. And it just like, no, if it's anything bad about Michael, I refuse to entertain the possibility that it's true. And there were a lot of incidents like that where he took advantage of people and got what he wanted by hurting others. And she just blew it all off, as if she, too, thought Michael was so exceptional that the rules didn't apply to him, just like Michael himself thought.
When we talk about the main motive for at this trial and what is been conveyed and what's theorized is that they talk about the financial situation, the deteriorating financial situation of Kathleen, and then the deteriorating financial prospects of Michael Peterson in terms of being an author as a motive. Tell us about what they did find out on both those fronts.
Well, the couple was in serious credit card debt. I mean, you know, it was like six figures of credit card debt. And the house needed some money injected into it. It was really getting to the point that it was critical. It needed a new roof. It needed the bats cleared out of the attic. I mean, there were a number of things that should have been regular maintenance for a house that old, but just hadn't been done for a few years. And so also Kathleen was putting the majority percentage of her salary back into an account that the company kept of her salary, so that she was retaining it for the future. And she was a breadwinner. I mean, Michael was getting a pension from his service in the military, and he was getting very diminishing returns on his royalties. And yes, he did have this one potential movie deal, but you know, that doesn't really pay the bills well. I mean, when you have an option on one of your books, they give you a small amount of money relative to the production cost of a film, and look into the possibilities of making a film and writing a script and all this. Until the movie's made, you basically don't see much at all. So that wasn't a big deal. The possibility was a big deal that it would eventually get made into movies, but most of them that are optioned do not. So, you know, his prospects were slim to none, and the three girls were in college. And the two grown boys were still getting money from them. And so things were getting a bit dire. And Michael Peterson never wanted anyone to think that he didn't have the money, so he just kept bringing up debt. And what the police believe is Kathleen had found out that he had been unfaithful to her and that she had threatened to leave. And when she threatened to leave, that meant she was taking all her income and taking her daughter away from that house. And that meant that Michael would now have four people that were financially dependent on him, and he would have his income just about cut off. So there was greed as a big incentive for ending her life.
And also, he had gotten away with throwing somebody down a staircase easily, getting away with murder.
Yep. When you,
why not try it again?
When you've committed a crime and you get away with it and don't pay the price, it enables you to commit that same crime again, or something even worse.
Now, in the book, and for those people that watch the Netflix Staircase, you also see somebody that was very, very interesting in the O.J. Simpson case, I thought. And he has done a thousand cases, Dr. Henry Lee. How does Dr. Henry Lee interpret this same crime scene? What does he have to say? And as you write in the book, it's very odd, his, again, demeanor and behavior on the stand.
Yeah, and it was very clear that there was no love lost between Dr. Lee and David Rudolph. It was pretty strange. I have never seen that kind of reaction between a defense attorney and their expert witness. Dr. Henry Lee said something that the nurses on the jury panel thought was particularly unintuitive, and that was that it was too much blood for a beating. Now,
wow.
That doesn't even sensible by any stretch of the imagination. And he also did this weird thing with watery ketchup and spitting it to show aspirated blood spatter looks like. And it seemed as if it wasn't an accident that he got a bunch of that all over David Rudolph's suit. So, yeah, there was some antagonism there. But the one thing that he said that I thought supported Michael Peterson's guilt was that after he gave testimony on direct about how stringing is not a method that's used anymore, and nobody uses that, it's ridiculous, which is what the state guy had done.
Right.
The prosecutor had him admit that, yes, he still does stringing himself. And he also said on the stand that he had reviewed Dwayne Deaver's information in his reports. And he said that it was clear from the photographs of the scene that there had been a point of impact in midair that caused blood spatter. Now, the defense was trying to say that all the blood spatter came when she fell back and hit her head. But here was their own witness saying, no, it wasn't hitting her head on the wall or the steps or the rail or anything like that. There was a point of impact with an object in Kathleen's head that was midair. And to me, that was one of the most damning pieces of evidence in the whole trial. The other piece that, to me, is the most damning piece of evidence were the red neurons in Kathleen's brain. Kathleen had red neurons that were found by a neurological pathologist with forensic experience. He found these red neurons, and the only time they appear in anyone's brain they've ever appeared is when someone slowly bled to death over a period of at least 2.5 hours. And they're not even sure that it might be as much as 3 hours. She had those in her brain. That means there was a very long time between when she was injured and knocked unconscious and when she bled to death. Michael Peterson said she was alone in the house for 45 minutes. That piece of evidence made Michael Peterson's story a total lie.
You write, too, and we just mentioned previously that the timeline is that she spoke to a Canadian colleague that you mentioned that she was going to have a meeting with on Sunday morning, and there was no evidence that she was slurred or that she was anything but her professional self at 11 p.m. that night. And then you're talking about 2:48 a.m. when the EMS arrived, I believe.
Yes, yes.
Very contrary to his story.
Oh, very much so. And, you know, and then there was another interesting piece of evidence that was not submitted in trial that I think explained some of the unanswered questions. The question, or the big question, was where was the murder weapon and what was the murder weapon? Well,
right.
Here's an interesting thing about Todd Peterson. On the shoulder of the T-shirt he was wearing, I'm not sure whether it was a T-shirt or if it was a sports shirt with a collar, but anyway, on the shoulder of that shirt, there was a contact blood stain, which meant that something that had blood on it rested on his shoulder for at least a brief time. Also, on the back of his shoe, there was a perfectly round drop of Kathleen's blood. So it was clear that whatever was on his shoulder had dropped a drop of blood straight down to the back of his shoe. What the police believe is that he came to the house, probably called by Michael Peterson, and saw what his father was doing, trying to clean up the scene, and told him to stop. And then he left and got rid of the murder weapon. Then he returned just as the first responders were arriving.
Right. And that would explain a lot of the behavior that Todd does, trying to interfere initially when the EMS and other investigators come to the home. He's trying to leave.
Yeah.
He's trying to offer his opinion. Of course, he's very, very strongly says, in my opinion, I think she was just shit-faced and fell down the stairs. So he is doing everything that will be consistent with somebody that has something to hide or some affiliation with the crime, certainly.
And you know, when he was told not to talk to each other about what's going on, just sit in this room quietly, he wouldn't stop talking. He tried to talk to everybody, and including his father. And he just was not listening to the police and following instructions. He was making a major nuisance of himself. And there's a dead woman laying there. Come on, grow up.
Now, you chronicle this entire ordeal, especially is striking to picture, because I have seen their photos of Martha and Margaret, the people with the most, I guess, the most to lose, the most, the people that lost the most, but the people that lose the most by having to realize that everybody, the people closest to them, they have to walk away, or Todd was involved, their stepfather was involved, and then this incredible realization of the horror that is Michael Peterson. Despite Rudolph and despite Henry Lee, what does the jury come back with a verdict? And what's Michael Peterson's reaction?
They came back with a verdict of guilty, and he was sentenced to life without parole. And the jury was pretty resolute in their feelings. I talked to a number of the jurors about it. And Michael Peterson, he continued to claim his innocence. And he, you know, told the kids that everything would be all right. But just the same, he was marched off in handcuffs and sent to prison.
Yes, it's an incredible tale, too, Kathleen's sister, Candace, and all of the people that are on the side of justice that want to see Michael Peterson get his due. And then his fragile, damaged, and family, and this con man, and you could see him in the dock like that. It's just, to me, he's just not a sympathetic character at all. And in the book, more so of exactly, less so the one-sidedness of a documentary as it's limited. This book covers every single aspect of this case, what made these jurors convict him, what made people in his own family finally realize that he was a double murderer. I want to thank you very much, Diane, for coming on and talking about Written in Blood, a true story of murder and a 16-year-old secret that tore a family apart. I guess people want to take a look at your other work. How do they? Do you have a website, Facebook page? Tell us about that.
Yes, I've got a website. It's DianeFanning.com. And you can find all my true crime and all my fiction books on there. And my next true crime book comes out April 30th, and it's called Death on the River.
Wow, looking forward to that. We'll have to have you back on talking about that, certainly. Thank you very much, Diane. You have a great evening. Thank you once again for coming on talking about Written in Blood. It's been fascinating.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.